Relax, we'll be in and out. Anyway, you've never seen my lab.
Oh, great. I get to see your nerd lab.
What's up?
Hello, Jake Bischoff's debut. Hopefully. Anyway, we are live at Mountain West Media Days from Green Valley Ranch. The preseason polls are out for the Mountain West. UNLV only picked to finish 7th. I think they're going to end up finishing higher than 7th. The two teams ahead of them that I would probably pick to drop below would be Fresno State and New Mexico. Fresno State lost two of its most important players from last season. They do return a lot more of the rotation, but they're pretty big losses for Fresno State. And then New Mexico. We've talked about New Mexico plenty. Paul Weir's loaded up with transfers simply on a talent base. He's got enough to compete in the Mountain West. You got Jaquan Lyles, who had 11 points per game at Ohio State. You got a guy from Towson who was at 19. Like, they've got plenty.
This they only is really where we lost. Throw our head back and laugh.
Don't you just do that all the time?
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay. They lose Anthony Mathis, but that's really it. So they should be good. The talent's there, the potential's there for New Mexico. But fun fact, Paul Weir's been the head coach in New Mexico for 2 seasons. He has a lower average KenPom ranking than Marvin Menzies did over those last 2 seasons. Marvin Menzies got fired. Paul Weir supposedly going to have a good team in 2019. So he hasn't had a good or hasn't had a top 100 Mountain West team yet since he's been at New Mexico. So I'm not really buying into
that. So he's due.
He might be due. Marvin Menzies would have been due too by that logic last year, and that didn't really work out very well. So I'm not really buying into that. They were picked to finish 3rd in the Mountain West, but I think the best way to probably look at the Mountain West is in tiers, like Utah State's. Yeah, you can say they're at the top by themselves, and then San Diego State, Nevada, Boise State. I think those are sort of the next best three in sort of tier two, and then, you know, UNLV, New Mexico, Fresno State, Air Force are probably all in the third tier. Like, all those teams are pretty similar. Like, wouldn't surprise me if they finish in any order. Air Force returns everybody. Granted, they only went 8-10 in a bad Mountain West last year, so they weren't exactly good last season, but they return everybody. And then the bottom tier would be Colorado State, Wyoming, and San Jose State, which is just, maybe San Jose State should be in its own tier, tier 5 by themselves, or tier 6 or out of the conference. But I think that would put UNLV anywhere from sort of 5th to 8th in the Mountain West. And, like, you could see Boise State or San Diego State falling back to that tier as well, but I expect both of them to be better than UNLV. So it's, I don't know, it's weird because most of the team, you take Utah State, they're the clear favorites. They've got two returning stars. But outside of that, the rest of this conference is a bunch of question marks. Like, your Boise State returns most of what it had, but Boise State wasn't all that good last season. They had a losing record in the Mountain West. You look at Nevada and New Mexico and San Diego State, they're all relying on transfers and new guys to come into the program and be good right away, for that to work and click right away. And you've got UNLV, obviously, a new head coach. So outside of Utah State, it's kind of like, all right, not sure really anything is solid. So UNLV could finish anywhere from whatever, 3rd to 8th to 9th or something like that, and it wouldn't be that big of a shock just because we don't actually know how good these teams are going to be, other than Utah State, because they're going so far today, they're just going to dominate the Mountain West based on today. Like, they're picked to finish 1st, unanimous pick to finish 1st, Sam Merrill's preseason player of the year. People finally realize Nemish Keita is actually good. He was voted the 2nd team All-Mountain West last year by the coaches, and according to their votes, he was the 9th best player in the Mountain West. He was voted the defensive player of the year, but only the 9th best player overall, and that was after dominating the conference for an entire season on the defensive end. So, not great. If we look at UNLV, nobody makes the All-Mountain West first team in the preseason. Jared, who do you think is more likely to make it at the end of the season, Amori Hardy or Donnie Tillman?
Probably Donnie Tillman.
Really? Why?
I guess I just think that, you know, they always vote weird, and sometimes Amori Hardy drives into the lane and, like, does, like, puts up a knuckleball and makes me go, oh, God, God, and then it goes in, and I'm like, oh, okay. All right. That worked. Never mind. We're good. Where I feel like it's going to be more consistently like, oh, okay, cool.
So I think it's Hardy simply based on volume, because he's going to have the ball in his hands. He should be getting the most shots for this team and the most assists under TJ Otzelberger, and I imagine when other coaches are game planning against UNLV, it's going to be, hey, how do we stop Amori Hardy? That's going to be the top of their list to do defensively. Donnie Tillman's going to be the secondary option. He's going to be a strong number two. And here's the thing. I expect Donnie Tillman to be incredibly efficient. this season, but I think Hardy's going to get the volume to where he's the one that's putting up the bigger numbers. But it could be Tillman. If teams are focused enough on taking away Hardy, that Tillman ends up getting more open shots and actually has a better season. But I think volume-wise, Hardy will be there, and coaches tend to be worse than the media when it comes to just voting for guys that have the best stats.
Oh, wow. So then, yeah, Jonah Antonio.
How many threes do you think he's actually going to shoot this year per game?
I want him to go 3 for 5 per game, and everyone just be like, 60%er! He's a 60% three-point shooter.
Would be incredible. All right, so we're going to have Mountain West Commissioner Craig Thompson joining us pretty soon, and we'll have Craig Smith, the head coach at Utah State, joining us a little bit later. So because of the condensed portion of this show, Bischoff Briefs goes now.
Okay, so on the air planning, do you want me to play the imaging, or do you want me to just start the briefs?
I don't care. Up to you.
I've done so many wrong things today, I figured might as well in for a penny, in for a pound. Kenyon Oblad completed 5 passes at or behind the line of scrimmage.
So if we go back to yesterday's show when we talked a lot about the quarterback position, Kenyon Oblad completed 11 passes against Vanderbilt. 5 of them were either at the line of scrimmage or behind it. Ultimately, his passing chart, he was 9 of 13 on passes under 10 yards. He had 2 passes that traveled 11 yards in the air. He was 1 of 2, and then he had the 63-yard touchdown that was over 40 yards in the air. So he really only took 1 shot down the field. Everything else was short. Even the 2 intermediate-range throws were 11-yarders. I don't usually track this, so I don't have actual data to compare it to, but he only threw 1 pass over the middle of the field in that game. Everything else was to the outside with either out routes or curls or flat routes, and that is exactly how you should be coaching a freshman quarterback. A, not many attempts, but B, almost everything is safe. Almost everything is to the outside and much less likely to get that picked off, where we've seen most of UNLV's interceptions has been quarterbacks trying to throw balls over the middle, and you only take 1 shot actually down the field. Everything else is in the short game. So he completed a lot of safe throws. It's also why I'm still not ecstatic about Kenyon Oblad's performance, because Armani Rogers probably completes all of those passes too. Like, he probably would have been 9 of 16, 10 of 16, not maybe 11 of 16. So I think that's the best thing the UNLV coaching staff did outside of running it 50-something times, was simply when they asked Oblad to pass it, it was here. This is the easiest throw we can have you make, and he made him.
Not a good day. The Golden Knights host the Predators tonight.
Jake Bischoff watch is in effect. Morning skate is at 10:30. Hopefully we get reports of Jake Bischoff skating with Nick Hague and Derek Englund as the extra, or maybe Gerard Gallant telling the media afterwards that Jake Bischoff is in, because I hope this is the day. I hope Jake Bischoff plays, mainly because here's another Derek Englund stat for you. 166 defensemen have played at least 50 minutes this year at 5-on-5. Derek Englund ranks 160th in Corsi. My one fear, though, Jared, this is what I'm actually afraid of. I think Jake Bischoff would be better off not playing and sitting in the press box than he would be getting paired with Derek Englund.
It's sort of like you getting paired with me.
Exactly. That's a very good analogy. It's probably your best analogy you've ever made on this show. Because here's the thing. If they take Englund out of the lineup and just put Bischoff and Hague together, that means one of those guys has to go from their natural left side and play on the right. Derek Englund is playing on the right now with Nick Hague, so the easier switch would be to take Nick Hague out and put Jake Bischoff in, if they do put Jake Bischoff in. So I'm just a little afraid of Derek Englund, because I feel like he's going to drag Jake Bischoff down, and I'm not going to get to say Jake Bischoff is any good, because his numbers are just going to be terrible.
Is it bad that the reason I hope he's a healthy scratch is because I didn't get to make any of the imaging that I wanted to make?
For what?
Like, I wanted to make a whole thing. Like, is Jake Bischoff starting tonight? No? Okay. Raiders right guard Gabe Jackson has returned to practice.
So Gabe Jackson had a knee injury in training camp, and he missed the first 5 games of the season, but now he is back, and this would be the first time the Raiders would have their offensive line put together, the one that they built in the offseason, Rodney Hudson at center, Incognito and Jackson at the guards, and then Colt Miller and Trent Brown at the tackles. The incredible part of the Raiders' offensive line is they are top 5 in the NFL so far in both pass blocking and run blocking. They are third by Football Outsiders for run blocking this year, and they are third in adjusted sack rate this season. So the offensive line has been pretty much as good as you could have hoped for if you're the Raiders. And, Jared, are you ready to give Tom Cable credit yet?
Sure.
Really? You are?
No. I mean, this is – all these players are technically offensive linemen, so I don't – like, I don't – he hasn't Tom Cabled this lineup yet.
But he's the one that wanted Colton Miller, and I imagine he wanted Richie Incognito.
I thought the Colton Miller thing was like, oh, I think he's a project, but he will be fine. It was where they took him.
Oh, yeah, that was always
the problem.
They panicked
and were like, Tom, who do you want? And yeah. He was like, I don't know, a tackle?
Nailed it. Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to bconnectedsports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It is the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com. Tyler Bischoff is
the dumbest smart person I have ever met in my life.
Technically Correct.
We are live from Mountain West Media Days here at Green Valley Ranch. Joining us now, the commissioner of the Mountain West, Craig Thompson. And Craig, I want to start with something that BJ Raines had reported a couple weeks ago about Boise State and them basically turning down the option to be on ESPN2 or ESPNU for a 9 p.m. basketball game in favor of being on ESPN3, a streaming way only, with a 7 p.m. start time. How does that conversation happen as far as schools, and how much power do they have when it comes to individual games and being on TV or streaming and what time the game starts?
Oh, I think you hit it right on the head. If they want to receive the revenue and have 40, 50 million more versus, I think, ESPN 3 now, ESPN Plus is in about 2.5 million homes. You know, if that's something that they feel strongly about, you know, they can address it, and we can ask ESPN if they'd be willing to not play on a 85 million platform and play on 2.5 million platform.
So it is ultimately you guys make a request to ESPN, and ESPN either says yes or no to that?
Correct.
Okay, so how often does that happen where a school says, yeah, we'd rather play streaming only and get an earlier start time?
I don't think it's too much, maybe a little more frequently basketball. Actually, it was New Mexico, and that's the only one this season. They said rather than play in front of a whole bunch of people in a national audience at 9, I'd rather stream it at 7.
As the commissioner, obviously not the one that's, you know, one of the fans going to the game, do you dislike when that happens? Like, would you prefer to have your teams on the bigger platform, even if it is a later start time?
You know, it's the fine balance of trying to get people into the arenas and coming to the games and having an interest versus, you know, what they're trying to do to promote their program and nationally. You know, the easy answer would be, no, I'd rather have them play in front of 85 million people, potentially. But, you know, we all know for a fact not 85 million people are watching. Maybe a couple hundred thousand are watching.
When do you think the next broadcast deal will be signed and announced for the Mountain West?
Well, we've been working, you know, all summer from the late spring. I think we're getting closer to resolution, and you know, there's some issues and some compromises that have to be made if we have more than one network involved. And so, you know, the conversations are progressing well. I said in there, it's maybe. We're getting into the fourth quarter now.
So is it going to be similar to the one right now where you have multiple partners and they go through the process of selecting games, or would it be more likely to be a one broadcast rights or one broadcast partner?
I would say it's more likely to be multiple.
So in similar setup now where, you know, ESPN and CBS are kind of the first tier and then it goes down from there?
Yes.
What did you think of the AAC and their deal with ESPN and ESPN Plus, where that's where all of their games will be?
I never would have done it. 12 years is a ridiculous amount of time, and they're going to spend a good amount of production dollars to produce. Almost 60-70% of their deal will be on ESPN Plus.
So the length is a problem, but would you have liked the idea of being on ESPN Plus with some of the games going to ESPN if it was a shorter deal?
Probably not.
So you like the idea of having ESPN and CBS Sports Network being able to put the games on those television channels.
Yeah, and you know, again, because our schools, many of our institutions don't have the wherewithal to produce those games at a broadcast quality level. And so let's say you get whatever millions in rights fees, and if you turn around and have to spend $1 million plus in production costs to put those games on, I think that's challenging.
How successful have the Mountain West games been that have been broadcasted on Facebook?
You know, pretty good. You know, billions of people could watch it. It was a great success, the Facebook game with Oregon State at Hawaii. It had a great number. In fact, the Oregon State fan said, this is better than the Pac-12 network. we can see it, and it's available, and we don't have to pay extra for it. So, you know, that's still a work in progress, and it's something that I think the industry is growing and progressing with.
So it's not that big of an issue for the Mountain West, but like the Pac-12 network doesn't have an agreement with DirecTV. If that was ever the case with one of your broadcast partners, how would that affect signing a new deal? If, oh, they're not available on DirecTV, they're not available on whatever that is, 40% of the people that have televisions.
Yeah. You know, it's a mindset. It depends. It's somewhat generational, how many people would rather and don't care what necessarily the medium is, as long as they can see the game. They just assume watching on their phone or their iPad or their computer, and it doesn't have to be linear on a 60-inch hanging off the wall.
Mountain West Commissioner Craig Thompson with us. So one of the big talking points this morning has been the potential of a 20-game schedule for the basketball side of the Mountain West. Would going to a 20-game schedule ultimately help this conference get more teams in the NCAA tournament?
I don't know about that. There's a number of reasons to favor it. Obviously, there is some dissension in people that say it might not favor my institution particularly, but scheduling has become so hard and so demanding. We had some schools even 10 days ago, early in October, that hadn't even filled out this year's schedule. And so it gives you an opportunity to get a home game and a road game against known quality competition, really at no cost.
So how do you balance, because you take UNLV, for example, can conceivably get pretty much any game that they would like to get versus an Air Force or a Wyoming who's going to struggle to get more games. Like, how do you balance that as the commissioner when it comes to, hey, we want to go to 20 because it's going to help out the Wyomings and the Air Force?
Well, I think UNLV would be much better served playing two more conference games than three or four of the people that are on their current schedule.
So how realistic is it for them to drop, if you add two more conference games, for them to drop the two bottom teams from their non-conference schedule rather than two of the middle or higher tier teams on their non-conference schedule?
I don't think it's a challenge at all. Just say, we're not going to play. It's in my gym, Thomas and Mack. We're not going to invite you.
Is that so for, say, a UNLV, like, what would you think their pushback to that would be if you say, hey, just don't play the bottom two teams, keep the rest of your schedule intact? Like, why? What would be the pushback from them on that?
I don't know. That's a question for UNLV.
So when we look at the 20-game schedule, how exactly would that go as far as scheduling games? Because this year you guys are playing games in early December, so how would that go in the future? Is how early the non-conference season has to start?
Yeah, it's like the other 11 conferences that play 20 games. You will play in December.
Is it this year with the ones being in very early December and then you go back to your non-conference schedule? How do you think that affects? Does that change anything on your end for like those games being in early December and the way the conference
schedule sets up? Probably no different than football. We play games in September, conference games in September. Not every conference game is played in October and November. You know, it's just an adjustment you make. But with the fewer non-conference quality opponents that are available, because all the conferences are going to 20 games, what is now a real problem and issue is probably going to exacerbate.
On the scheduling part of it, is there a potential that you guys in the future would open the season or play conference games in, you know, earlier, mid to late November instead of December?
Could. Probably not, but probably we're not going to be playing much in early December either, because with the Atlantic 10 Challenge coming up, it's going to be late December games, conference games.
So couple years ago, you guys were getting just one team in the NCAA tournament. The last couple of years, you've gotten multiple teams in there. But how, like, what's the most important thing for the Mountain West? Not just to get multiple teams in, but get to the point where you're having a couple of teams that are 2, 3, 4, 5 seeds rather than everybody being a 7 or an 8 or a 9 seed from the conference.
Yeah, both. You know, you want multiple teams in the NCAA tournament, and scheduling is a very important part of that. And to get the better seeds, we had single-digit seeds last year, and both lost their first-round games. Our history in the NCAA tournament, I think we've had 5 Sweet 16 teams in 20 years. So it's not been tremendous, but you know we the goal should be back to the 3 or 4 teams in the NCAA tournament, not just the automatic qualifier and a single at large.
So do you, when you are sort of setting out goals for the conference, is it more about simply getting quantity teams in there and not necessarily where they're seated at in the NCAA tournament?
Well, you know, it's the oldest cliche in the world is, you know, you can play yourself out of a bad seat by winning the game. You can't win a game if you're not in the tournament. So the first and foremost is to get multiple teams into the tournament. And those are luck of the draw. You know, you look at the seed and it doesn't necessarily mean a 3 is always going to win. Last year's a great example. Every 9 seed beat all 8 seeds. Every 10 seed beat all 7 seeds. 3 of the 4 12 seeds beat a 5 seed. So what does a seed mean?
Yeah, so when you look at getting better or getting more teams in and even getting higher seeds in the NCAA tournament, how much does that fall on the UNLVs, the San Diego States, and the New Mexicos to getting back to where the – because those are the schools with the – I guess, most likelihood to be powerhouses in basketball. How much is it on those 3 schools to get back to that level rather than relying on, say, Nevada or Utah State to be at the top of the conference?
Well, you know, you'd want those programs, like you just stated, historically. They've been prominent basketball programs. You know, back to the scheduling issue, Utah State, who's predicted to win the league this year, only plays New Mexico once at the Pit. They don't get them in Logan. And they don't get Boise State at home. New Mexico. And so, you know, the disparity in the scheduling is challenging too because, you know, people think, well, I'm adding 2 of the lesser prominent basketball programs if we go to 20 games. Well, it works in reverse. You don't get to play 2 of the best teams either.
Well, he is Craig Thompson, the commissioner of the Mountain West. Craig, we appreciate the time stopping by and talking with us.
Good to be with you. So, thanks for coming out.
Thank you. We will take a break. We'll come back. We got UNLV football news as Kenyon Oblad is still going to be the starter for the Rebels on Friday.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
There's no I in team. Yeah, there's no you either. So I guess if I'm not on the team and you're not on the team, nobody's on the goddamn team. The team sucks.
It's Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
We are live from Mountain West Media Days as UNLV basketball picked to finish 7th in the Mountain West. Utah State picked to win the conference, but we will turn to football as Kenyon Oblad is going to start again for UNLV on Friday as they take on Fresno State. There's really no change at all in the quarterback situation for UNLV. Oblad is the starter like he was last week, and the same scenario for Armani Rogers. He has a knee injury. He is cleared to play, but he is not 100%, so UNLV is not going to use him unless it is an emergency. He is essentially 3rd on the depth chart for this game because Max Gillum is back. So if there was a quarterback change or whatever, more than likely it would be Gillum coming in, and Armani would likely only play if there were 2 injuries to Gillum or Oblad ahead of him. So if there is not a healthy Armani Rogers or simply not 100% Armani Rogers with a knee injury, you stick with Oblad, because if Armani can't run, that's what you're doing. But what is weird here with the Armani Rogers injury? He gets hurt at the end of the first half against Wyoming. Kenyon Oblad finishes that game, and then Rogers gets cleared to play the next week against Boise State. And on Monday of that week, before they played Boise State, when we talked to Tony Sanchez, he had not decided on what he was going to do at his quarterback spot. He was considering using Armani Rogers, even though he was not 100%, because he was cleared to play. And then, what was it, Thursday of that week, Oblad was named the starter. And then during that game, Steve Cofield asked Sanchez at halftime in the halftime interview if he was going to consider bringing in Armani Rodgers, and Sanchez shot it down and basically said, no, Armani's only an emergency option at this point. And then last week, Rodgers still cleared to play, but Sanchez on Monday said, nope, it's Oblad, and Rodgers is only coming in an emergency. And now again, Monday, Oblad's the starter, Rodgers only going to be used as an emergency quarterback. And what's weird to me about that is, A, Armani Rodgers is cleared to play and not able to play, but the weird part is that the first game after the injury, Tony Sanchez was considering using Armani Rodgers despite not being at 100%. We're now 3 weeks later, and he's not even considering it. So I assume, since he's cleared to play, the knee injury is not getting worse. I would assume it's getting better, and it doesn't seem like it's a serious injury if he's cleared to play but just not 100%. So it's, to me, the weird part there is, why are we already casting aside Armani Rodgers' potential to play in the game? Like, why is it already, oh no, he can't play, it's only an emergency situation if he's in there? So which brings me to my conspiracy theory. There's two possible things here that I think could be happening. One, this is Tony Sanchez's way of simply benching Armani Rodgers without actually benching him for Kenyon Oblad. He's saying, oh, he's hurt, he can't give us his best running ability, so we're going to go with Kenyon Oblad instead because Armani's not 100%. Tony Sanchez softening the blow of the Armani Rodgers benching. Or Armani Rodgers doesn't want to play anymore because he wants to transfer and he wants a medical redshirt. Right now, Armani Rodgers, at the end of this season, would have 1 year of eligibility left. But he has only played in 4 games, which would make him eligible for a medical redshirt. If he plays in another game, he will not be eligible for a medical redshirt. So conceivably, Armani Rodgers could look at this and say, well, I'm going to transfer at the end of this year. If I get a medical redshirt for this year, I'll still have 2 years of eligibility to go play somewhere, so I'm just not going to play the rest of this season and grad transfer. Because he could grad transfer conceivably. This is his 4th year at UNLV, so conceivably he could be on pace to graduate, grad transfer, be eligible immediately if he gets the medical redshirt, have 2 years to play. So I don't actually know if either of those things are happening, but it just is very, very strange the way they are treating Armani Rodgers, because it's gone from 3 weeks ago it was, well, he could play, to now he's completely ruled out unless Max Gillum and Kenyon Oblad get hurt. So there you go. The one thing I will say on the medical redshirt, it'd be a little bit of a question because technically he is cleared to play. So when you're trying to get a medical redshirt, they could say, well, it wasn't a season-ending injury. You could have played. You just weren't at 100%, so you chose not to. So that a little tricky in terms of getting that. But that there's your two conspiracy theories on why Armani Rodgers is not even an option to play a quarterback for UNLV right now.
Okay, well, it's also football. So technically, like, cleared to play and healthy or who, like, one's the moon and one's the sun.
I mean, yeah, but it's the NCAA, so, like, logic isn't exactly the strong suit of these decisions. Like, we honestly have no idea what goes into the decision-making of why some kids get cleared to play and why. So, like, we literally don't know. We just find out, oh, this kid's cleared, oh, this kid's not cleared. Eh, we'll wait till the end of the season and then decide if this kid's ineligible or not. Like, we don't have any idea what they use to determine if kids get a redshirt year or get cleared to play right away. So, I don't know. To me, it's just very, very strange to me that Armani is cleared to play and 3 weeks ago it was an option and now all of a sudden it's completely ruled out and there's no change whatsoever. And I don't know if it's Tony Sanchez softening the blow for Armani Rodgers or if the better conspiracy theory is that Armani Rodgers is choosing this. Armani Rodgers is saying, no, I don't want to play anymore because I can get a medical redshirt and I can still have 2 years of eligibility. And he doesn't even have to transfer. He could get a medical redshirt and have 2 years of eligibility left at UNLV. Like, that, it benefits him even if he sticks around at UNLV. So, but conceivably, if he's able to get that medical redshirt and is on track to graduate, he could go somewhere else and have 2 years to play and be the quarterback somewhere else or whatever they want, whatever he wants to do. So there's your conspiracy theory. That being said, Tony Sanchez isn't going to rush back to Armani Rodgers until they lose a game. Like, regardless of how good Kenyon Oblad plays, if they keep winning, I doubt he's changing to any quarterback anytime soon. The interesting thing will be what happens if the offense and Kenyon Oblad struggle against Fresno State, and do we see Max Gillum? Does he put Armani Rodgers back in there? Like, that's the question. If they do exactly what they did against Vanderbilt, run the ball 50-something times, throw it 16 times, it doesn't really matter who the quarterback is. Like, Max Gillum can probably do an amicable job doing that as well, but if they have to throw it 26 times because they're down by 14 in the fourth quarter against Fresno State, that's sort of the question is, and Oblat struggles, what do you do next? Because turning to Max Killam isn't exactly the most enticing option because he's probably the least exciting of these three quarterbacks.
Here's my... Didn't we do this last year when Armani was hurt? Like, he had just started to get healthy again, and they're like, no, we're going to keep rolling with Max.
Well, so it was the Hawaii game, and I do not remember who started that game, but both quarterbacks played in the first half, and then Armani played the entire second half. I can't remember who
they
started.
They almost won that game if it weren't for... You know, four
Siobhan Cordero coming in and throwing three touchdown passes on four total passes in the fourth quarter. Yes, they blew, what was that, a 13-point lead in the fourth quarter?
Very efficiently.
That game was, so UNLV got the ball back like on their own 10 or something and needed to drive the field to try to take the lead with like a minute and a half to go. And that was when people were saying, well, put in Max Killam because you got to throw the ball down the field. And they went with Armani Rodgers, and it was like a four and out or something like that because they went for it on fourth down and got sacked. So it didn't work out very well. But we've actually seen it the last 2 years that Armani Rodgers got hurt. Because Armani Rodgers was cleared to play and was ready to go in that game against, what was it, BYU? And they stuck with Johnny Stanton, and they lost. And then they were like, oh, we got to score 35 points to win. We can't do this with Johnny Stanton. Let's get in there, Armani. Still didn't really work. But we've seen the same scenario play out in a couple of years. Armani Rodgers gets hurt. They bring in a different quarterback. Johnny Stanton looked good for two games, and then, oh, we have to score a lot. Max Killam looked bad for five games. The offense and the defense was very good against San Diego State. They got a win, and then, oh, yeah, it's not actually good. It's all a mirage when the defense actually has a good game. So that's what I'm curious. UNLV winning any games the rest of the year comes down to how many points does the defense give up. It's not really a matter of how good the offense is. It's about, does the defense give up 17, 21, 24, or does the defense give up 38? Because if they give up 38, I don't honestly think either quarterback in there is going to outscore that. If they give up 17, I think both quarterbacks are going to outscore that. I think it's not going to matter who the quarterback is. So that's probably more important. And unfortunately for UNLV, there's not much reason to suggest they can repeat that that 10-point performance against Vanderbilt where they give the offense the ball five times in Vanderbilt's territory.
Man, I don't even know what to do at this point. Like, I feel like they could literally beat anyone randomly and then lose to anyone.
Well,
like,
I have
no consistency. I have no read on this team, and we are, what, five games into the season?
You just have to hope Javon White and Rashad Jackson are awesome for the rest of time. Like, and they are.
Oh,
those two are awesome.
They're great.
They got to make up for the rest of the team, though.
Just a one-man picking machine.
Two. It's two. There's two of them. This is the improvement of the Tony Sanchez era. At one point, it was just Tao Lotulelei running around there, tackling everybody, making all the plays. Now there's two guys that do that.
Oh, good God.
It's terrific. They've fixed it. Everything is going swell for UNLV football. So we'll see what they do defensively. Vanderbilt's really bad. I keep telling you, Vanderbilt and UNLV are the same exact team. Derek Mason, Vanderbilt's head coach, yesterday, did a coach's show and basically said, yeah, we should have ran the ball a lot more. He was like, yeah, our running back averaged 9 yards a carry. We should have given it more than 15 times a game, which is exactly what Tony Sanchez said before they played Vanderbilt. It was like, yeah, we need to run the ball more. We can't throw it 50 times. They're the same exact team, just one place in the SEC.
It's the Spider-Man meme.
Exactly. It's unbelievable how similar UNLV and Vanderbilt are right now. Like, they've got great punters, and they've got a terrible quarterback
30!
Situation, and they've got a running back that they can't give the ball to enough. Ridiculous.
Can I ask you, all right, so this Fresno State game comes down to a pivotal, like, fourth and one. Who do you even feel confident running a play on fourth and one? Because to me, it's Armani Rodgers, just dive forward.
Yeah, I mean, if it's fourth and one, you just run a quarterback sneak with Armani Rodgers. If it's, like, fourth and three, I'd still
Vic
lean.
Vic Viramonte.
Yes, Vic Viramonte. I think if it's fourth and three, I think I'd go Armani Rodgers in a zone read with Charles Williams. If it's, like, fourth and six, all right, now give me, like, Kenyon Oblad because I might have to throw it 7 yards down the field.
Oh.
But fourth and one, just sneak it with the guy that's 6'10".
Yeah, that's why I'm just like, this is, maybe we need a three quarterback system.
Who's the third, Viramontes or Gillum?
I was thinking Wildcat Charles Williams.
Oh, Charles Williams and Chad Magger together in the backfield?
Yes.
That might be the best. Maybe put Tylee Collins back there. You can put all three. You run the triple option with those three.
Are we ready to go to break?
Yeah, we'll go to break. Hopefully when we come back, we will have Utah State head coach Craig Smith.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Tyler Bischoff is
technically correct. The best kind of correct.
We are back live from Mountain West Media Days at Green Valley Ranch as we wrap up our show. The press box was live here earlier with Clay and Ed. Check that out on lvsportsnetwork.com. Once that, are you in charge of posting that, Jared?
Yep.
Okay, post mine first, then theirs.
Okay.
Thank you. So, out here at Mountain West Media Days, but I do want to flip back to football because UNLV got a win, so that means we get to be optimistic, and UNLV fans get to be optimistic, and I posted on Twitter, after they beat Vanderbilt, can UNLV go 4-2 and actually win six games for the season and get to a bowl game? And there's actually quite a bit of optimism. J.D. Douglas said San Diego State, Colorado State, San Jose State, Reno, boom. On the path 13, I give them a 40% chance.
Okay.
That's high. That's a high chance that they go 4-2. Eddie G said, after the last two defensive performances and the efficiency on offense, I think all the games are winnable. Coach Ray said, the only team that scares me is Hawaii. RJ said, got to go 3-0 on the road. Those home games are pretty rough. I think they can do it, but I wouldn't bet on it. So, 4-2 finish. UNLV has not had a four-win stretch in, or four wins in a six-game stretch under Tony Sanchez. One time they won three games in a six-game stretch back in 2017, but they've never done four in six games. So it'd have to be the best six-game stretch of the Sanchez era. Hell, it would actually be 5-7 because
yeah, I was
they just beat Vanderbilt. So they need to win 5 out of 7 basically to end the year. The good news, they do not play good teams the rest of the way. If we look at my favorite stat of S&P Plus, the efficiency rankings, UNLV is 117th. The team they just beat, Vanderbilt, is 94th now. Fresno State, San Diego State are 76 and 79. Hawaii is 84. And then Colorado State, San Jose State, and Nevada are all 100th or worse. So they play three, we'll say, average teams in Fresno State, San Diego State, and Hawaii, and then three bad teams in Colorado State, San Jose State, and Nevada. So it's certainly possible that all UNLV has to do is beat three bad teams and one average team, and they get 4-2 in this last six games, and they get six wins on the season. But the problem is UNLV is also a bad team. Like, the chances of them consistently performing against Colorado State, San Jose State, and Nevada is very, very low. Like, the chances that they actually pull that off, they just don't do that. It's not go against anything UNLV football has ever done. So it's not a very difficult schedule. Like, Fresno State and San Diego State have fallen. Like, they're not as good as we thought they were at the beginning of the year, so they're not as hard of a games. But it's still relying on UNLV to show any form of consistency, which is not happened in the Tony Sanchez era. And I say the Tony Sanchez era. It's not happened in UNLV football history for them to be consistent.
Okay, have we determined, though, and I don't know if we touched on this very much yesterday, but because my memory is terrible, have we determined, was Vanderbilt the team that they beat that they weren't supposed to beat? Or is that team still on the schedule somewhere?
So, that's...
And have Vanderbilt, they lost to the team that they weren't supposed to lose yet? Or is that still on the upcoming schedule? Because that's 1-1 right there.
That is a good question. So, I think we should put Vanderbilt in the category of team they were not supposed to beat that they beat. Because even though Vanderbilt is very, very bad, still a 14-point underdog, and if you take S&P Plus, S&P Plus still says that that's a 12-point margin between those two teams. So I think that one is fair, even though we've trashed Vanderbilt for the better part of 2 weeks. I still think that one's fair to put there. Have they lost the team they weren't supposed to lose to? Who would be the option for that? Arkansas State?
I want to say North.
I mean, cause they were home favorites against Arkansas State and then got trounced.
I just feel like it's always San Jose State. Like, that just feels right.
Yeah, the problem is UNLV's ranked lower than San Jose State this year, so...
Oh, well, maybe it's both.
None of the games the rest of the season.
Can you still tie in college football, or is it not 1947?
I think, like, you'd have to play so far into overtime that the lights just go out or the stadium just starts falling apart, one of the two. Like, you have to have some sort of extenuating circumstances. UNLV and San Jose State in 8 overtimes, and Sam Boyd just says, oh, yeah, we got to close down now. This is it. This is how we're ending Sam Boyd, UNLV and San Jose State.
Oh, my God. They literally just demolish it mid-7th overtime.
Tied at 14 in overtime number 9.
So I think it's possible for them to go 4-2, especially if you believe that the good team that they're supposed to beat is coming up and the bad team they're supposed to lose to is coming up.
It's possible. I think it's just a matter of, do you actually believe what the defense did against Vanderbilt? Like, do you actually believe that? And they don't have to be that good. They just have to be, like, half as good as that. Do you actually believe that that defense is going to be around for the last, or at least 4 of the last 6 games of the season? Because if it is, then absolutely. If you can hold any of these teams to 17 points, you absolutely have a chance to win all those. Like, the funny thing, I talk about the quarterback so much and how the main reason I think Armani Rodgers should be the quarterback if he's 100% is because I think he gives them the best chance to score 35 points per game. And I think this defense is going to give up 30-plus points most of the time, so you need the quarterback that's going to score 35, or at least has the better chance to score 35 points. But if you look, take that San Diego State game, for example. That's a game that you can absolutely win that game 17-16. Like, there's no doubt that UNLV could go in there, and San Diego State's going to try to kill. They try to kill off every game they play in. Right? They're going to try to be good defensively and try to run the ball and control the clock. So you might hold San Diego State to 17 points in that game. And if Oblad can get you to 21, it's not that crazy of a feat to ask him to do. You might win that game with a game manager. So I could actually, like, if Armani's 100% healthy, I can actually see you making the argument, hey, we're going to leave Kenyon Oblad in there because, well, we just need to manage this game to a win. Now, when you play Hawaii, your defense has given up 45 points. Like, that's happening. So you've got to score 51. So I don't know that Kenyon Oblad is leading you to 51 points, but I think you take the San Diego State game, it's possible. And then Colorado State, San Jose State, Nevada, none of them are really good enough offensively that you're that terrified of them. The problem is that UNLV's defense normally gets torched by the bad teams too.
All right, so if you had to put a percentage on it of them going 6-0 in the next game, how many decibels are... Like, is it 0.0001%? Or are you saying just flat 0?
Lights FC have a better chance to make the playoffs.
All right, that's fair.
And I believe they're at 6 decimal places before you get to the 1.
Oh, man.
Yeah, 6 right. And 0? Like, if you gave me 4 and 2, I might give you like 5% that happens.
All right, you have about a minute. So give me tell me what, I don't know, how is Mountain West Media Day? I don't know.
I mean, it's dead compared to football. There was like 6 different cities sent radio stations down here. Yeah, but no, we're not. Not really. Not really. People still care about football. That's still the important. It's only 1 day for basketball. They do football for 2 days. It's ridiculous. So, yeah, they're not giving basketball the respect they need, right? UNLV wishes it was a basketball school. The best part of the day so far is Craig Thompson talking about the 20-game schedule, and he said, you know, 2 schools were against it, and then when asked if UNLV was one of those schools, he says, I don't want to throw them on the bus, but yes, they are one of the 2 schools, because it's UNLV and San Diego State that can actually go and schedule the good teams, that can actually schedule quality non-conference opponents, but they're going to have to be playing 20 conference games pretty soon. So that'll do it from Mountain West Media Days. Thanks, Jared.
There are no rules.